Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 120, Negative Knitting. Sunday, May 15th, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Today's episode includes the following segments: Ever-Expanding Skill Set, Off the Shelf, Yarn Lover at Large, and so forth. Negative knitting. It's been quite a while since a week has passed and I haven't seen any progress on my projects. And in fact, this week I have less to show than I did one Sunday ago. Part of the reason for that is really a good thing. We've finally had clear, sunny, warmer weather this week, and I've focused on working in my garden every day after work and just trying to break things down and doing one section at a time. The property at Yin Hu is densely wooded, so I have some perennial gardens with very little sun, and then I have one patch just on the side of the house with a concrete staircase, and I usually put a potted garden there that gets a few hours of sun per day. It's good for herbs, but it isn't good for growing vegetables. So I've just been really working on clearing weeds, clearing small oak trees. We had such a hammering of acorns last fall, and now every one of them is working its way to becoming an oak tree. So I keep going through and pulling them out as I see them. And over the few years that we've had some hardscaping done and we've planted a perennial garden, things have filled in more and more. And that keeps the weeding at a minimum. Although in spring, after a lot of rain, there are always a lot of plants growing that I don't want in my garden. So I just work through and pull them out. In the evenings, this has meant that I'm pretty tired and I don't really have the energy to focus on knitting projects. And that was compounded by the fact that my Agatha socks were going so well that I started thinking about giving them as a gift rather than keeping them for myself. And then I started thinking that if I were going to give them, they probably wouldn't be big enough because I have very narrow ankles and none of my gift recipients do. And so I thought what I really should do at this point is rip it out and cast on for the larger size. So I did. I ripped out the sock, the first sock, which I had knit all the way to the heel turn, and I cast on 72 stitches on size zero needles, but with a really nice tubular cast on. It makes a great stretchy edge. The tubular bind off also makes a great stretchy cuff. And so I've completed the twisted rib cuff, and now I'm working on the leg portion with the lattice pattern. It's going well, and I'm looking forward to continuing work on these socks, but it's just meant negative knitting. When I haven't been working outside on my gardening, I have been working away at cooking with a big bunch of rhubarb I brought back from my mother's house after visiting her on Mother's Day. We went outside to pick some rhubarb, and she has a pretty big patch of it that she tends without a great deal of effort. Rhubarb is a cool climate crop, so if you live in hot weather, chances are you won't find it locally. You may not even be familiar with it at all. It looks like celery with a really big, tough leaf. Unlike celery's leaves, the leaves of rhubarb are not edible. They contain oxalic acid, and this makes a great mordant for dyeing. Well, I don't know if it's great. I can't report on that. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. Those leaves can be discarded in a compost heap. However, they will not interfere with the quality of compost. And the stalks look quite a bit like celery stalks. They're a little bit less fibrous, and they can also tend toward reddish in color. So you'll get a range from a celery-like green to a really deep red. The stalks are plucked off right at the root, and if you buy a bunch of rhubarb, it's typically sold by the bunch. You might see dirty bases of stalks where the rhubarb was pulled right out of the ground. You really don't need to do much trimming of rhubarb. If there's kind of a dried out end, you'll want to cut that off. And then you'll just want to clean and perhaps trim the bottoms of the stalks. Most recipes using rhubarb call for you to just cut the rhubarb into 1/4 inch to 1 inch pieces. And they start to break down very quickly when you heat them. If you feel like a few of the stalks of rhubarb are a little bit fibrous, you can peel just a bit of the outer stalk off, and that usually yields good results if the majority of your rhubarb is in good condition. Rhubarb freezes extremely well, and it refrigerates for quite a long time. I would say 1 to 2 weeks if you have it stored well in a very cool place in your refrigerator, you should be able to keep using it without any problem. This week I had amazing success with a recipe titled Rhubarb Ginger Downside Up Oatmeal Cake. I was intrigued by this recipe because it looked pretty simple in terms of ingredients, but it used some really interesting techniques. And it also looked like a great presentation. I did make a few adjustments to the recipe, which I will recommend, and I have a few tips. And I'm going to talk about this at length because I think everyone should try this recipe if you can get your hands on some rhubarb. The recipe is baked in a cast iron skillet. And one of the first concerns I had was the condition of my cast iron skillet and the other things I cook in it. I cook onions, garlic, bacon in my cast iron skillet, and those aren't flavors that I want to linger in a sweet dessert. So I took a tip. I think I've seen this years and years ago from Emeril Lagasse, how to clean a cast iron skillet. I used some coarse salt and olive oil, and I just took a paper towel and I really gave that cast iron skillet a good scrub, lots of abrasion. And then I discarded the salt and I did rinse the inside out with very warm water and then let it dry. So into the cast iron skillet, which is on warm, go some butter, which melts completely, and then brown sugar. I cut the butter and sugar substantially in this recipe, so I will add those notes in the show notes for this episode. Once the brown sugar is evenly distributed around the bottom of the pan, it will not all melt immediately. I turned the heat off, and then you add some cut-up rhubarb, about 3 cups, and that has been mixed with grated ginger. The recipe calls for 1 tablespoon of grated ginger. The first time I used 1 tablespoon, and the second time I used 2. All of the rhubarb and ginger is mixed together, and then it's distributed evenly around the bottom of the pan. This is an oatmeal cake, and the technique for this is something I had never used in a cake before, but it's really tasty. You take, I think it's 1/2 cup of oats. The recipe recommended the regular oats, not the quick cooking kind, but I only had the quick cooking kind. So that's what I used. And then some boiling water and some additional butter, which melts in the boiling water. And essentially you make some oatmeal and you set that aside while you're mixing up the rest of the ingredients. The dry ingredients are flour, baking powder, baking soda, and salt. And the wet ingredients are more sugar, white sugar, brown sugar, and 1 egg. And I think I also used a little bit of grated lemon rind and vanilla. Then you add the oatmeal to the wet ingredients. You very quickly, with a spatula, mix the wet and dry ingredients. And then you pour that very carefully. It will be very thick and difficult to spread without disrupting your rhubarb. But you pour that very carefully over the top of the rhubarb in the cast iron pan and make sure it's distributed evenly. That goes into a 350-degree oven for 25 to 30 minutes. It bakes up beautifully. Then I removed it from the oven, took a very sharp knife and ran it around the outside of the pan just to loosen the cake, and I let that sit for about 10 minutes before inverting. The inversion is the most difficult part of this cake in my mind because you have a very hot and very heavy cast iron skillet and you need to flip it upside down in order to get all of that gooey and delicious glistening rhubarb on the top of your cake. I took a flat sheet pan, put it over the cast iron skillet, and then I used full length oven mitts, and with both hands, I just flipped that over and the cast iron skillet pulled off. There was no sticking, no mess. And then I just transferred that cake to a cake plate. It serves a lot of people. It's beautiful, tasty, and this got great reviews both at home and with my sheep to shawl classmates because I made this recipe again and I took it to my sheep to shawl class yesterday. Yarns at Yanhu listeners will know that I sanction every dessert item as a viable breakfast food, but I think this cake is particularly good for breakfast or brunch because of the oatmeal. And because it's not incredibly sweet, it's very dense. And I think you could make some great variations, perhaps, with other fruits. Pineapple upside down cake is very traditional, but I think you could try maybe some other things and some other flavorings in the cake. But the techniques are really top notch. Sometimes I feel like recipes are just lists of ingredients, and if you had half a brain, you could figure it out yourself. But with this recipe, I feel like it offers some truly interesting flavor combinations and culinary techniques with a very, very good result that's not too difficult to achieve. So I highly recommend giving this a shot. I'll be continuing to cook with rhubarb all month long, and there is some enthusiastic recipe sharing and conversation over on the hashtag Power Pantry thread for May. So check it out and contribute your own ideas. Usually when I take rhubarb from my mom's garden, I quickly trim the leaves off right there where we're standing in the garden. And her rhubarb patch is in a shaded area that's very near the compost heap. So I just slice those tops off and throw the rhubarb leaves onto the compost. This time, however, I took those leaves home and I worked on making a mordant with rhubarb leaves, which I knew could be done, but I hadn't really investigated it. My research concluded that I needed about a pound of rhubarb leaves and a huge pot of water. So I brought this to a simmer on our outside grill. It is quite dangerous to complete this process in an area that isn't well ventilated. So I figured that the best thing to do would be to put this on the grill outside after we had grilled our dinner that evening. And since it was so nice and warm out so many evenings this week, it was a perfect opportunity. So I submerged all of the rhubarb leaves into a big pot of clear water. I brought that to a simmer. I let it simmer for about 40 minutes. And by then the fire was dying down. So I just pulled the dampers on the fire and let it sit overnight. It's actually still sitting with the rhubarb leaves in the pot because I haven't found the appropriate containers I want to use to store it. So there's no light, there's no heat, it's just sitting there with the rhubarb leaves, which my instructors at Fibercraft Studio said was okay, but I would like to strain that off this weekend and store it. Initially, I had been looking for some really large glass containers because I like to store that kind of stuff in a non-reactive container. But the Wild Color book that I just reread this morning said you could store it in a plastic container, which really surprised me. So I guess now I can look for a plastic container, and I'm wondering if the reason it said that was that it should be stored away from light, or that light might disrupt the mordanting properties of this rhubarb solution. I'm not sure, but in any case, what I would like to try is an experiment where I mordant a skein of essentially the same yarn, which will be hand spun yarn from the same Jacob sheep. I have several skeins that I've been working on. I'd like to mordant one in the rhubarb solution and one in alum, which is my usual method of doing a mordant and the one that's recommended by Fibercraft Studio. And then I would like to dye those skeins in the same sort of plant dye and see if there's any difference in the color or the saturation or the quality of the color fastness of the dye. And then I, you know, can also offer up that solution to anyone else who wants to try working with it. It is recommended that you use gloves and you do everything with a rhubarb mordant in a very well-ventilated area. At the Fibercraft Studio this week, we worked on so many things. It was really a very busy day. We shared all of the hand-knit, hand-sewn bunnies that we had made. We had another session of watercolor painting, which was a surprise. We were informed earlier in the week that we would have our watercolor instruction extended from 3 sessions to 5. And this weekend, we worked with greens with our teacher, Brigitta. And the directions were to layer on a series of paints in a pale yellow, a deeper yellow, and an orange red, and then to start adding two values of blue over those colors on the watercolor paper, and to make as many different greens as possible. A section of my watercolor is the cover art for this week. When I was standing over the painting, applying the blue over the other colors, I felt like I was achieving so many varieties of green. It just seemed wondrous to me how much green I was getting. And then when I stood back and took a photo, it looks like a yellow painting with a little bit of green. I don't know if that's just the quality of the photo. I'm not sure how the character of the painting will change as it dries. One thing I've noticed is when I leave the studio for lunch, you leave a wet painting behind and you have this image of it in your mind and you take a photo of it. And then the next week when you return and Brigitte has all of our watercolors displayed, the quality of the dried paint is very different from the wet. So I will be curious to see how that looks. I feel like with this painting, I was able to execute some of the elements that Brigitte has been instilling in us. In quite a few of the other classmates, I have a good deal of experience with Waldorf watercolor painting, in which there should be no lines. That's been a struggle for me. But I feel like this time I just worked on applying color rather than making lines. And I haven't tried to make a thing. I think one instinct when you get a paintbrush in your hand is to draw with the paint and make, you know, images, make a thing. I haven't tried to make a thing. I don't have any problem with that direction. But not to have any lines is really difficult. So I feel like the success of this painting is that at the very least, I was able to just apply patches of color without thinking about line. We talked a great deal about using a mordant and what that means for dyeing protein fibers. And one of the passages I found in a text at the Fibercraft Studio is from Rebecca Burgess. She has an interesting analogy for mordant. The mordant is a translator that speaks both the language of the fiber and the language of the dye. We talked about the root of the word mordant, meaning to bite, and soaking some animal fiber in a mordant allows the dye material to bite into the yarn and stay there when you rinse or wash it so that it really does turn a color. Otherwise, you could put fiber or yarn into a very vibrant color solution, and when you remove it, it hasn't really changed substantially. At Fibercraft Studio, our first method of using natural dyes is to mordant some yarn or fiber and then place dye materials into a jar, add very hot water, and watch the color start to release from the dye materials, and then add the yarn or fiber, fill the jar with water up to the tippy top, and then let that sit in a sunny place for about a week. This method can yield all sorts of colorful results, but I think it's also a method of observation. So our teachers talked about this being a process and to really observe and evaluate that process. The choices we had were marigold, red onion skin, dyer's chamomile, the dried roots of lady's bedstraw, and Yellow Cosmos. Last year when we did this activity, I had chosen red onion skin, so I decided to try some other things this year. And I selected some ladies' bed straw. However, since I got home, I was reading about ladies' bed straw, and it seems like you need quite a big quantity of ladies' bed straw to fiber in order to yield a result. It does look like very, very fine pieces of madder root, so the color I'm expecting could be similar to that, but in my case, I think it will be much more faint. In the other jar, I put some fiber to dye with Dyer's chamomile as well as a little bit of Yellow Cosmos. There was powdery bits of Yellow Cosmos left over in the basket after it had gone around and people were selecting what they wanted. And so I added a little bit of two things into my jar, and that is yielding a very vibrant orange color. Over the course of the week, I will check the jars to make sure that the water level is all the way up to the top. That prevents mold from growing. And I'll look at the color in the jars to observe what is happening with the dyeing. Off the shelf. I haven't talked about this in a while, but our Eat Your Words read-along will begin on June 1st. There's an excellent conversation thread that's already begun. Most of the posts in the thread so far are about book suggestions and also films having to do with food. And I've created a page for the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry that lists a whole bunch of book titles in three different categories. There's food memoir, food journalism, and fiction involving food. If you'd like to participate, just take a look at the thread, take a look at the lists on this page, and select a book either to purchase on your e-reader or to borrow from a public library and read along. You can read one book for the whole summer. You can read multiple books and join in the conversation. If you have additional suggestions, please post them. I will monitor this thread as carefully as I can, and I will add suggestions to the page as I see them. I feel like this is a great way to expand our skill set and have some really easy reading over the summer and maybe educate ourselves about how to eat better or some topic concerning food or just purely for entertainment. There will be a prize for each month of the read-along. I have acquired the first prize, which was a generous gift from Carol of Foster Sheep Farm in Schuylerville, New York. Just as I was leaving with my purchases, Carol said, "Oh, you should take a skein of yarn for the podcast." And she pointed to a basket of yarns she had dyed that is a new blend of United States produced superwash yarn. It's in a fingering weight, and the colorway I chose was not named, but I'm calling it Creamsicle because it's a beautiful blend of undyed and then a few different values of orange. I think it would be really fun to knit with over the summer months, and that will be the prize for June. All you need to do to be in the running for winning this beautiful skein of yarn is to participate in the thread. And toward the end of each month, June, July, and August, I will just look at the posts and choose a random number post to win the prize. The more you chatter, the more chances you will have to win. If you are interested in contributing a prize for either July or August, those spots are still open. I will be posting a photograph of Carol's beautiful yarn on the Ravelry thread so that you can see it. And of course, I will also be mentioning and linking to her shop. So if you'd like to have a little bit of publicity and advertisement, as well as give something away to Yarns at Yinhu listeners, let me know with a personal message on Ravelry and we'll get your prize in the running. Yarn lover at large, I'd like to recommend the Fiber Festival at Fibercraft Studio in Chestnut Ridge, New York, for anyone who's interested in family-friendly activities on Sunday, May 29th. This is the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend, and the festival runs from 10 to 4 a.m., rain or shine. There's no admission fee. There is a small fee for some of the activities. There's a silent auction, a plant sale. You can buy beautiful products from Fibercraft Studio. And all the money that's raised is used to promote and to host events at the studio all year long. So this is the largest, you know, revenue-generating event that the studio has. There's lots of additional information about this festival online, so I will certainly link to it in the show notes. Some of the things you can do are learning how to spin, to felt, to use natural dyes. There's a puppet show. There's also a plant sale with dye plants available. It's just a really nice day on the beautiful grounds of the Threefold Center. And that's the larger Waldorf Center where Fibercraft Studio is located. I think there might even be animals at this festival. Really a beautiful, great day. So if you can work it into your plans, if you're staying locally for Memorial Day weekend to avoid the crowds, or if you will be in that area for Memorial Day, you should definitely consider stopping in. And so forth. After the comments I made about Me Made May and my own challenges in creating a handmade wardrobe, I've had so many really beautiful responses and very personal responses, both in personal messages and also in the thread on Ravelry. That's been really gratifying this week as I've been thinking about my next sewing project and thinking about this idea of balance and how social media both inspires and interferes with my productivity and also this gap. Jacqueline Salem posted a video. I will also link to that because I think it's great. Some of you may be familiar with Ira Glass's comments about the taste versus skill gap when you are a maker. Really, when he made those comments many years ago, he was talking about the taste ability gap in terms of writing, that people who write usually are inspired to write because they are very intense readers who love written language, and they have many, many years of experience, and they've built up a quality of taste, of being able to judge what is good, what is poor writing. But then when they do writing of their own, there's a gap between what they want to achieve and what they know to be good quality and what they're able to produce. And really, the only way you can shorten that gap is to continue to write, to continue to practice and improve your skills. And this is true in any craft, that there's typically a gap between taste and ability. I think that gets truer and truer when we take on a new craft or a new skill as adults, because sometimes our taste, our aesthetic has crystallized and we are really at the beginning stages in terms of our ability. There's a great animated video with just a segment of this speech. I think it's just over 2 minutes long that Jacqueline shared with me. I had never seen it before. And before I even responded, thank you, I had already started sharing it with colleagues. And I just think it's such a great way to raise some conversation about this topic. And certainly I was thinking about how it applied to me in sewing, you know, after a lifetime of purchasing clothes and developing taste and being an adult and having an income that would support purchases of clothing that were to my taste. Now that I'm thinking about making my own clothing, you know, there's a really big gap. And I was thinking about another gap that exists. And this is something that I've commented to friends before, that one of the biggest enemies of creating a handmade wardrobe is to have a mother who's an amazing seamstress. I grew up around sewing all my life. Some of my earliest memories are of my mother fitting the dresses for an entire bridal party that was standing around in their slips and underwear in our dining room, and my mom was adjusting the lengths of their hems. And that being the case, I have a great deal of knowledge and information about sewing and garment making. I have excellent vocabulary. I know what things mean. I know what techniques are. I know a lot about sewing machines. I know a lot about fit and drape. But that doesn't mean that I can achieve those things when I'm working on my own project. And sometimes the knowledge I have really gets in the way of careful skill building, because I am quite apt to jump ahead in the things I take on because I have so much information. And I think that, added to the taste ability gap, really can create some frustration. In some ways, it's an advantage, and in other ways, I think it's an impediment. So I've been thinking about that a lot, of course, while I did zero sewing this week. But based on the success of my previous attempt at drafting a skirt from a pattern, making my own pattern from a skirt that I loved, I think that the best thing to do would be to forge ahead with something I see as a little bit difficult and intimidating, and just see if I can make some progress on it every day this week. This is the Kiyomi dress. It's a design by Lotta Jansdotter in her book Everyday Style. The dress itself is actually very simple, and the pattern is simple, not very many pieces. I already have it cut out. I have the pattern cut out. I don't have the fabric for the dress cut out. And that is really the thing that's limiting me, is that this fabric is so slippery that I'm scared of it. I feel like I'm going to screw it up cutting it, and then I won't even be able to work on the dress. But what do I have to lose, right? I mean, it's never going to be a dress if it just sits in one piece folded up on the end of my ironing board. The fabric has been laundered, and I have some great tips from my mom for cutting it, and also for using some of the fabric scraps and really setting aside one sewing session just to experiment with the fabric. She said to try ironing it with different settings on my iron so I know what my limits are. Try sewing with different threads. And she suggested that I may want a silk thread or a very high quality, kind of expensive thread could be easier to work with than the typical synthetic threads that I've been using to sew, you know, cotton and cotton linen blends. So I might stop at the store and take a look at the different varieties of thread and pick up some different choices. And she said to try sewing with different stitch lengths, different stitch tension, trying different types of seams, and really before I start sewing on the dress, to get a lot of experience just sewing with that fabric. One of the reasons for this is that unpicking a seam with this fabric will probably result in visible damage, holes, snagging, or something like that. It's just not that forgiving in terms of the fabric. This is a very loose and flowing garment. So I think that if I had to make a little bit of adjustment on where a seam is, I have a bit of room. It's not a fitted piece. So that's an advantage, but I think just getting over the fear factor is the major thing. And that will be the challenge that I address this week. And as always, I will share the results of my experiments and my progress with Yarns at Yinhu listeners in the next episode. Have a great week.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Curtis, but out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, or liking the show's Facebook page, or joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry. The music for the episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.